Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
Please keep your Bibles open to that text. We're going to be studying that this morning. And it is good to be back at Graymere. I love this church. I love your reputation. I love your good works. I love the hospitality that a person feels even when they walk in your doors, as I did this morning. Just good to be here. And there is no minister in the brotherhood that I have more respect for than I do for Andrew Phillips. And I'm so glad that he and Catherine are here and have invested their lives here, and I think it shows in the kind of people you are and the kinds of things that you are doing. It's good to be back in Middle Tennessee. We took a sojourn for 30 years to Arkansas, and we moved back about a year ago. We got into our house that we built. Not a good thing to do in the year 2021, but we built a house, and we got into that early December, and once again, I'm able to go around and to be with churches and to preach, and I'm loving being in McMinnville. I'm loving being back in Middle Tennessee. I want to, I'm still trying to sort of figure out my, how I see what, there it is. Okay, over there. A few years ago, I was asked at Harding University for their lectureship to speak on the final night of lectureship on the story of the Good Samaritan. It was a lectureship on parables, and I was given probably the biggest softball that there was, preach on the Good Samaritan. I did what preachers typically do when we're assigned something like that, and you go back and you look at what you've done before on the Good Samaritan. I was shocked when I realized that in 25 years of full-time congregational work, I had not one sermon on the Good Samaritan. I had included it in a lot of different sermons, but never had I just had a sermon on the Good Samaritan. So I sort of sank down into that again and worked through the story of the Good Samaritan. And I was amazed how this story, that is maybe the most famous story in all of the Bible, and it's something that a lot of Americans today know this story and don't even know it's from the Bible. But as I began to plunge into this story again, I found it's incredibly difficult. It's incredibly easy and accessible, and it's right there for us to understand. It's straightforward. And yet there are depths of meaning that we'll never completely grasp. It felt like something I couldn't quite get my arms completely around. The parable of the Good Samaritan. The story, as has just been read to us, is profoundly simple, and it's the people of the story are folks that we know all too well. A man is going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. If you were a Jew, when you left Jerusalem, you went down, whichever direction you went from. And it's 17 miles away, east-northeast of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is about 2,500 feet in elevation. And Jericho is 700 feet below sea level. It's a journey that takes you down and down into the desert, and you're just north of the northern tip of the Dead Sea. This man is going down through this desolate country, and even if you were on a tour bus today and you drove from Jerusalem to Jericho, you would have the feeling that you're going through the wilderness. You would feel you're in desolate country. As this man travels, he falls among robbers, and they beat him, they strip him, they rob him, and they leave him for dead. Along comes a priest. He's been in Jerusalem doing his temple service for some time, and he's coming home, and so he walks by and he sees what's going on, and he walks by, as the text says, on the other side of the road. Was it fear? What was it? Was it the uncleanness of the whole mess? What was it? We don't really know, but we know he walked by on the other side. Along comes a Levite. also had been in Jerusalem, also involved in temple service. And there he's coming home, he sees this mess, and he walks by on the other side. And then a Samaritan walks by. And the Samaritan doesn't go to the other side of the road. Instead, he has, the text says, compassion on him. And he binds up his wounds, and he pours on oil and wine, and he puts him on his animal, and he takes him to an inn, and he takes care of him, and he leaves him at the inn with 2 denarii and tells the innkeeper, "You take care of him, and if it costs more than this, I'll pay you when I get back." And Jesus asks the question, "Who then is the neighbor?" It's an incredible, incredible piece of teaching. As Jesus puts a story in front of us that all of us can immediately walk into. I think it's why it's so powerful. We read that story, and I think sometimes we identify with the man who is beaten and robbed, the man who's left for dead, the man who is crying out, "Somebody help me." And every one of us knows what it's like to be at our wits' end and to need help, and to be so grateful if anybody comes by and offers us any kind of encouragement or assistance. We've been that person before. And then there's the priest and the Levite. And every one of us knows what it's like to be confronted with an opportunity to help somebody, but for whatever reason, maybe we're afraid, maybe we're just too busy. Whatever reason, we walk by on the other side of the road. And we know how awful that feels when we look back on that experience. We also have been the Good Samaritan. I am absolutely certain that every single person here in this room today has had that opportunity where you have seen somebody who has needed you, needed what you had to offer. And you have sacrificially given of yourself, and you've helped them. And have we ever felt nearer to the heart of God than when we do something like that? We know what it's like to be the Good Samaritan. I have a friend who's like me. He's a grandfather. And he was telling me about the family lunch that they have after church every Sunday. And one Sunday, his little preschool granddaughter they were talking, and like a good grandfather, he tries to pull her out about her Sunday school class. "Well, what did you talk about today?" And she said, "We talked about the man who got hurt." And so he knew they were talking about the Good Samaritan. And he said, well, tell me about it. And she describes the story. And the grandfather says, "And who was the hero of that story?" And he said, his granddaughter, with big eyes and without missing a beat, said, "The donkey." Well, maybe sometimes there are stories where even we do well if we can just identify with the donkey that carries the man to the inn. The story is profound in its simplicity, but also in the way that it goes right to our hearts. There's something in preaching that Andrew and I both know that this can be a temptation. Fred Craddock, a famous writer on preaching, said that we've got to avoid the temptation to sometimes take a text and boil off all the water and preach the stain at the bottom of the cup. It's possible to take a story like this and to reduce it to 3 things I'm going to tell you today about the Good Samaritan. 1, 2, and 3, and that's it. But instead, the Good Samaritan, I think, is a story more like a beautiful diamond. And every time we turn it in the light, we see some new facet. We see a color we've not seen before. There's something about the brilliance of this gem that we've underappreciated in the past. And so this morning, as we talk about this story, I hope that you see something you've never seen before. I hope you take home with you something you've never taken before. And if we study this story 1,000 times, I hope that's the experience we have with the Good Samaritan. It all starts with the man who comes to question Jesus. Right before our text that was read this morning, we find the setup for this story, beginning in verse 25 of Luke chapter 10. Behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And he said to him, "What is written in the law? How do you read it?" And he answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You have answered correctly. Do this, and you will live." And then verse 29. Notice that it says, "He, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, 'And who is my neighbor?'" So, what kind of man is this, and what's in his heart? I don't think the indication is that he is a humble God seeker. I think instead we find that the man comes in verse 25 to test Jesus. And in verse 29, he comes to justify himself. And maybe one other thing in the text that gives us a little insight into this man is at the end of the story when Jesus asked the question, verse 36, "Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?" And he said, "Not the Good Samaritan." He didn't even say the Samaritan. It seems that he wants to sort of skirt even saying that or accepting that there was something good that this man did. And so he simply says, "The one who showed him mercy." I had a good Samaritan moment in my life a few years ago. I'd been in Washington, D.C. for a time. Let me back up. I'd been in Washington, D.C. for a time, and I had heard at that conference the public relations team for Emory University Hospital. And the people there were talking about the event that took place in their lives when they brought Kent Brantley back from Liberia to Emory University Hospital, and he was sick and maybe dying of Ebola. And they told the story about how that when the word got out, Emory University Hospital was hammered in the media, both in the national media and especially in social media. Because even though there are about five or six hospitals like this around the country, and they go through full dress rehearsal for events just like what they were going through with Brantley, even though this is something that the government has realized the world is so small, and one day of plane travel, germs in one part of the world can be in every other part of the world. And even though they were prepared for this, folks were saying things like, "He's a missionary. He made this decision. He deserves to die." And because of that, they simply said for 2 weeks, all we could do was put out accurate information. We couldn't convince anybody because nobody was in the mood for being persuaded. But we could simply give what is accurate information and see if it was ever going to take hold. And they said a couple of weeks into this, finally our better angels appeared. And people began to soften on this and to see what was really going on. Well, after I was in D.C. and hearing those folks talk, it was just a short time later, a couple of weeks later, that we had Kent Brantley on the Harding campus to tell his story. And he talked about being a physician who went with the Good Samaritan organization over to Liberia because there had been this terrible outbreak of Ebola. And we didn't know how to treat it, and we didn't know how to cure it for sure. And so he went over there as a missionary at heart, and worked in a hospital there. And he told us about how he got it, he thinks. He said that the hospital had an Ebola section of the hospital, and everything that they did by the same standards you would use in a United States hospital. But they had an Ebola section, and then they had a general section. And he said he thinks he got Ebola over in the general section of the hospital, that he and another physician had spent an entire night, working through the night, trying to save two young mothers who were delivering their children. And after a long and just a terrible night, they lost both mothers and both children. But he says, I think that's where I got Ebola. When he got Ebola, he said very quickly it just ravaged his body. He talked about how he was completely helpless. Here he had been the physician taking care of people, quickly became so helpless that the nurses he worked with had to diaper him. He talked about how he was given the telephone to call his parents and his siblings to say goodbye. And about how they wept because this wasn't a, I'll keep you posted. This is the last time we'll probably ever talk. And he talked about the blood transfusion. He talked about how three successive days he had a blood transfusion. And how the first day it came from the blood bank in the hospital. And the second day he got his blood directly from one of his co-workers. And the third day, he got a blood transfusion from a 14-year-old Liberian boy. And as he was telling us this story, he talked about this 14-year-old Liberian boy who had gotten over Ebola, something that they knew of almost nobody who had. He had gotten over Ebola. His parents brought him. They wanted him to give the transfusion. He wanted to give the transfusion to this missionary doctor who came to help their people. And then Brantley tells an auditorium full of people that night, he says, and he was a Muslim. And when he said that, I realized I just had the closest thing to a Good Samaritan moment I may ever have in my life. When Jesus is telling this story and he talks about the priest and the Levite, and he finally gets to saying, the man who came by and helped, and he was a Samaritan. I think it would have been like somebody slapping you. I think it was just a bucket of cold water in the face. It's something that would wake you up. It's something you didn't expect. Oh, and I think you would hear all across the auditorium, as we sort of did that night, everybody inhaling together. I think that's what happened when Jesus told this story the first time. It was something that caught them completely off guard, something they absolutely did not expect. The question that Jesus refused to answer was, and who is my neighbor? The man asks, okay, I have to love my neighbor as myself, but who is my neighbor? And what the man is trying to do is to whittle down this category so it's manageable. And so, as the text says, he can justify himself. But Jesus has this habit all the way through the Gospels, that Jesus realizes that the right answer to the wrong question will leave us in the wrong place. The right answer to the wrong question will leave us in the wrong place. And oftentimes, people would ask Jesus the wrong question. And they had to have been frustrated. Sometimes we get frustrated. Jesus didn't answer the question that he was asked. Jesus knows that he has to answer the right question. And the question for him is not the question of, who is my neighbor? What person do I have to love? That's not the question. The question that Jesus knew he needed to answer was the question of who is a neighbor. There is a writer by the name of Frederick Buechner in his book Wishful Thinking. He said, since this man was a lawyer, we can imagine his answering his own question would have been something like this. The man who comes and asks Jesus the question, of who is my neighbor, maybe he expected something like this. A neighbor, hereinafter referred to as the party of the first part, shall be construed as meaning a person of Jewish descent whose legal residence is within a radius of no more than 3 statute miles from one's own legal residence, unless there is another person of Jewish descent, hereinafter referred to as the party of the second part, living closer to the party of the first part than the one is oneself. In which case, the party of the second part is to be construed as neighbor to the party of the first part, and one is oneself relieved of all responsibility of any sort or kind whatsoever. A writer by the name of Grevin has written, one cannot define one's neighbor. One can only be a neighbor. And Daryl Brock, in his commentary on this text, says, neighbors can come from surprising places. And I think we can say that in the Gospel of Luke, virtue and faith, heroic faith, comes from the most surprising people. A few years ago, my wife and I went to Harding University in Greece, a semester abroad program, and we lived just outside of Athens. And I taught a class on the Bible class on the life of the Apostle Paul and public speaking, and Ann taught a phys ed class and taught what is called EdFed, Educational Foundations. And she had studied for this and read books and had talked to some teachers and all about this. And before she lectured each day there that summer in Greece, before she lectured to her class, I was her first student. So we would sit there in our room at night, and I would get the lecture for EdFed. I still think that Harding should put 3 hours of credit on my transcript for having passed Educational Foundations. And I remember one night when she was talking about educational theory, and she said, you know, there's the idea of moral development, intellectual development, that some people espouse has to do with the idea of folders. And the question is, are you giving your students folders? And the idea is that a good teacher doesn't just teach a fact, but they give a folder. And they introduce a concept, maybe like the subjunctive in the English language. And a student's never heard of that before. But after a good teacher has given them a folder, then every time they hear that, they got a place to put that. And it doesn't fall on the ground and go away and be useless to them. Or maybe if somebody teaches a new concept in math, or somebody in accounting talks about debits and credits, what you're doing is giving a student a folder, and they have a place to put something that they didn't have before. And I thought about that later. See, I did pass EdFed. I'm telling you I did. That I thought about it later as it related to this, and I thought about how we see it in the Gospel of Luke. And I thought of how we see it in places like the story of Mary, the mother of Jesus, in Luke chapter 1. An unwed, pregnant peasant girl. Do you see goodness? Do you see nobility? Do you see something to admire in that? You throw that category out there, and most people have no folder for that. But in the Gospel of Luke, we find that when she receives the message about what she is about to do, Mary's response is, "Behold, I am the servant of the Lord. Let it be to me according to your word." And you and I are in awe of Mary and of her faith, and of her humility and her obedience. In Luke chapter 5, verse 27, it's the story of Levi, who is at the tax booth. Someone who would have been totally disregarded in Jewish culture. Jews who have made themselves Gentiles. People whose testimony was not even welcomed in a Jewish court of law. And yet, when Jesus says, "Follow me," he leaves everything. And he rises and he follows Jesus. You have a folder for a good tax collector. They probably didn't. And Jesus hands them one. In Luke chapter 7, there's the story of a centurion. And the centurion has a servant who is ill. He calls for Jesus, "Would you come and heal him?" An expression of incredible humility, incredible faith. But this is a centurion. This is an officer in an occupying army. You hate him and his kind and what they're doing to your land. And yet this man calls for Jesus. And so Jesus heads in that direction. And before Jesus gets there, the man says, "Don't come. I get this whole Jew Gentile thing. And I know that you can't come into my house, but you're a man of authority. I understand authority. You say to someone, go, and they go. And someone, they come, and they come." And so he tells Jesus, "Just speak the word." And Jesus responds in verse 9. "He marveled at him, and he turned to the crowd that followed him and said, 'I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith.'" They probably didn't have a folder for a good centurion. And Jesus hands them one. The next one on our list is this one woman who's just known as the sinful woman. From Luke chapter 7, she comes with the alabaster vial of ointment. The entire society has just sort of characterized her, labeled her as immoral. And after she does what she does in anointing Jesus, Jesus says, "I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much." Do you have a folder for a good, sinful woman? In Luke chapter 8, the woman with the 12-year issue of blood, she saw herself as unclean. Everyone else did too. She tries to touch the garment of Jesus without being seen. Jesus knows the power went out from him, and so he stops. He stops so that he can bless her. And in front of everybody that's around there, this woman who is known to be perpetually unclean, Jesus says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." And then Luke chapter 17, we come back to the word Samaritan. 10 lepers come to Jesus to be healed, and he does. And then as they're going off, one of them comes back to thank Jesus, and he is what? A Samaritan. And Jesus says to him, he says, "Your faith has made you well." I've used that story a lot of times. And it always seems to me that Jesus should be saying, you know, "Your gratitude has made you well." But it's not. It's "Your faith has made you whole." There's Zacchaeus in Luke chapter 19. He is not just a tax collector, he is a chief tax collector. And Luke includes the little detail that would have been especially infuriating, and he was rich. I don't believe there's any doubt that this man was the single most hated man in Jericho when Jesus came through. Jesus goes to his house, and Zacchaeus stands up and he offers to make things right and to give of his fortune to people who needed it. And Jesus says then in his presence and to the people around, he says, "Today salvation has come to this house, for he also is a son of Abraham." Luke 23, another centurion. This centurion is at the cross of Jesus. And as Jesus dies, this centurion, a hated officer in an occupying army, this centurion says, "Certainly this man was innocent." One of the great confessions that we find in the Gospel of Luke, and it's on the lips of a Gentile Roman centurion. Acts chapter 1, verse 8. Acts, which is Luke volume 2. That Jesus says, "And the Spirit's going to come on you with power. And when he does," he says to the disciples, "and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in Judea, and you're about to gasp, and in Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. Do you have a file for that? So this morning we have a question for us. And the question is, do you have a file for that? Whatever that is. I brought some with me in case you might need some. I have one file here that some men probably need. It is a file for good women. I have a file for some people who maybe have really been hurt or betrayed. A file that says good men. I have a file that says good white people. I have a file that says good black people. I have a file that some of you may need today that says good Democrats. And if you don't need that file, you need the other one that says good Republicans. I have a file that says good immigrants. I have a file that says good prisoners. I have a file that says good politicians. I have a file for good rich people. You have one of those? How about one that's a file for good poor people? Or a file for good educated people? Or a file for good uneducated people? Do you have a file for those things? When I've shared this with people in other places, one of the most interesting things that happens to me is that sometimes people will come up afterward, whisper in my ear, "Can I have that file that says?" Because they realize that Jesus has opened their hearts that day to something that maybe their heart had been closed to before. Going back to the text, Jesus said, "Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?" And he said, "The one who showed him mercy." And here's the message for Jesus to you and me today. Jesus said to him, "You go and do likewise." The message is simple. You go. You go and do likewise. May we hear the word of the Lord today. We conclude the sermon this morning by offering the invitation. And if you're ready to follow a Savior like that, if you are ready to walk in the steps of Jesus, if you are ready to put your trust in Him, to turn from serving self and serving Jesus, if you are ready to confess Him as Lord and be buried with Him in baptism this morning, participate in His death, burial, and resurrection, and arise to walk in newness of life, or if you have some burden you need to bring before your brothers and sisters here in this congregation, we're all going to stand and sing to encourage you. May we all respond to the Lord in whatever way we need to this morning. As together we stand. As together we stand.